Hello, conversationalists, problem solvers, designers, and listeners. I'm Grant Faulkner, and I'm with my co-host, Brooke Warner, who has been good at all those things in the 3 years we've been doing this podcast together, and probably beyond that, actually. And Brooke, I'm focusing on these words because our guest today, Fred Dust, wrote this fascinating book about designing conversations. And when I first heard this term, I took a step back because we don't normally think of conversations as something to be designed. We think of designing buildings or designing clothes or designing cars, you know, designing tangible things in the world. But then as I learned more about what he meant by designing conversations, conversations that are like truly creative, I thought it was genius because having conversations is the work of many of our lives. And it's the thing many of us do most during the day. Some jobs are almost entirely about having conversations, and conversations are obviously at the center of our lives and our relationships with friends and family and partners. I think learning how to have creative conversation comes in very handy as a writer as well. Whether you're working with a beta reader or a writing group or having a tough conversation with an editor, agent, or publicist. And Brooke, I bet you've designed conversations when you've worked with authors and that you've learned a lot about how to have those conversations over the years. So I was wondering if you can give us, you know, how you approach giving feedback, either as a writing coach or an editor, and how you make the experience creative.
Yeah, you know, I hadn't heard that term before we started talking about Fred's book this week in preparation. So it did get me thinking. I definitely think that I have designed conversations, but not intentionally so, not with the kind of language that Fred offers in his book. And so I'm really excited to start trying that because I think it can be so intentional and therefore much more helpful to people. And I was also thinking that, you know, writers of fiction and memoir especially are actually practiced at designing conversations in their own work. You know, there's this way that we're always thinking about conversations, but then we're not always doing the work that goes into, okay, well, how is my own reaction playing into this, for instance? But I do think about that, of course, like my own reactivity or when we interview Fred later, he's going to talk about, you know, places where you get triggered or places where your emotions come into play. And I am very conscious of that because of the role I have with authors, that they're very sensitive to their work. The fact that you're putting something into the world that is really their creative child and the care that needs to go into that. And at the same time, holding the line as the publisher around what we think is the best thing to do. So I think I do get kind of pushed into these creative conversations all the time. And sometimes I fail and sometimes I think I do a pretty good job. But I'm curious, Grant, because I know you were really moved by the book. So from having finished it, what do you think it means to design conversations?
Yeah, it means many things. And I think it's interesting because we're living in an age where our conversations are so often going awry. Fred says in his book that in order to redesign our social structures, we have to redesign its core working tool, which is conversation itself. And if you think about it, this is also the case for, you know, marriages that stop working or workplaces that become dysfunctional. If people want to win the conversation or take an I told you so attitude towards things, you know, the conversation is likely not only to be not creative, it's probably going to be destructive. And I enjoyed Fred's book because he covers things like how we have to be committed to a conversation, which means entering it with a spirit of exploration rather than judgment. And if you think about it, exploration is inherently creative, but judgments tend to close doors. And I put this in practice recently. I actually had a tough conversation with my son the other night, and it was interesting because I took some guidance from the book, talked about how we are going to ask each other questions and explore each other's viewpoints instead of making decisions or judgments. And it's amazing how that one simple approach to frame the conversation relieved tensions and opened up possibilities and true dialogue. And I think we tend to leap into conversations without thinking about them too much, without designing them, which is why things often go wrong. I think of this especially in terms of the writing workshops I've been in that are so often uncomfortable. And that's so often why I think writing groups implode, is that people aren't really designing the structure of how people are interacting. And that happens all too frequently. And I think it's because, you know, it's because people haven't really taken a thoughtful approach to how to get feedback or give it. And my favorite technique I learned about getting feedback about your writing is to to think about the feedback you want. So for example, sometimes you only want to hear what's working. You want to build on your momentum and understand your strengths. And other times you want a very thorough critique of everything that's not working. So you want a deeper critique. But even with a deeper critique, I think it's good to guide your readers with questions so that you're getting constructive feedback and relieving the burden from them and creating a dialogue instead of bad feelings. So Brooke, I wondered if you have any thoughts for, you know, designing feedback from others or designing your own feedback to people.
Yeah, it's something I've been conscious of. Like I was saying, I obviously in the kinds of conversations that I have to have with authors about covers and about their work and all of that stuff, you need to approach that with some degree of tact, of course, or else people are going to get defensive or feel bad or whatever. And I have also certainly been on the receiving end of the wrong kind of feedback. So I know what that feels like too. And it does inform me for sure. So I do warn my writers and authors, especially when they're putting their work out to people like their beta readers, to be sure to ask for specifics, you know, so that they get what they want from their readers instead of what they don't want. So I'll advise them to do something like include a letter that says, I'm asking for feedback around my characters. Are they believable? Or was there any place where you felt lost? You know, that kind of thing. And then to ask them to specifically refrain from input about how the book could be better, because that honestly never goes well. I remember I had an experience like that. The first anthology that I was ever put in charge of when I was a young editor at North Atlantic Books was about Abu Ghraib and the prison abuse and torture that was a big news story at the time in 2004. And my boss said that I could write a piece for the book. So I was super excited about that. And I was young and probably in over my head in many ways on the topic, but it was also this awesome opportunity. And so at the time, the smartest person I knew in my writing circles, or rather my sort of professional circles, I should say, was a friend of mine who was studying at Cal and who ultimately went on to become a well-respected teacher. But she read my piece and eviscerated it, you know, said like, in essence, there was nothing worthy of publishing. She didn't give me any constructive feedback, you know, just it's not good. And of course, it was super hurtful, but it also made me really angry. And mostly because my boss liked the piece and had some constructive feedback and edited it. And then it became part of that anthology. And that experience, because it was so early on in my career, did shape the way I give feedback. And it also helps to have some understanding of having good boundaries and not handing over something to someone because you're just expecting them to say, oh my gosh, I love it so much. You're a total genius. You know, like, don't do that.
That's the hope. It's always the hope, strangely enough. Yeah. Fred goes into some great tips about this too. So I won't reveal what he says, but just, you know, so the listeners keep listening on for these kind of practical tips. And I think Fred's book can really help with these inevitable tough conversations you might have with an editor who has a different vision for your book or who puts forward a cover design that's off target. You know, you've got to design a conversation that allows you to speak up, but you also need to keep that collaborative spirit and work relationship intact. And Fred talks about having conversations that matter. So he's not talking about all conversations. You know, you don't have to design all conversations, just the ones that, you know, matter, and they matter because they're tough, but you still have to have them. And the key thing he says is to design the conversation so that the dialogue moves forward, which isn't easy because these conversations are often located on a minefield. You know, there might be an imbalance of power or a lack of purpose, or you end up falling into critique and defensiveness. So I think that's what one part of the book is, just practicing so that doesn't happen. And, you know, it's interesting for me to think of moments when just a single ill-chosen word can change things for the worse. But that's also his point, that we shouldn't be the victims of conversations like that. We need to develop the tools to make conversations generative and to redirect them, you know, especially if there's an ill-chosen word that might send things spiraling the wrong way.
Yeah, you're so right, Grant. And this is a topic every person on the planet can benefit from, because as you said, our lives are largely about the conversations we have. So why not train ourselves to have better ones? So let's do that. We'll be back for a fun and creative conversation with Fred Dust right after this break.
So, hey, listeners, Brooke and I want to let you know that we are teaching an online class coming up on June 12th. It's called 5 Things I've Learned About What It Takes to Finish a Book. They wouldn't let us call it 5 Things We've Learned About What It takes to finish a book. So part of the class will be sorting out whose lessons you're learning, but we'll try to make that part fun and easy.
That's right, Grant. We had to make that work for this incredible series, Five Things I've Learned. And I am excited about it because it's the first time we will have ever taught together. And what it takes to finish a book is going to cover a lot of ground. Like our show, it's going to have some how-to and some inspiration. And it's also a great space to connect with other writers and people who care about writing and books.
Yeah. And, you know, if we haven't learn some vital lessons about how to finish a book at this point, you know, we should call it quits, right? We've talked to all of these experts and we have all this wisdom from ourselves of the books we've started. So other than that deep wisdom of how to write and finish a book, Brooke, why do you think people should register other than the low price of $40?
Yeah, well, I know we're all tired of Zooming, but I also love the intimacy of these Zoom spaces where we're there together live. And I've been looking at our notes and we've got some really fabulous stuff. So if this is your year to finish a book, I can promise at least one really meaningful takeaway that will help you over the finish line. I don't know, Grant, I wish we had a giveaway or maybe that you were Oprah and you could give everyone in the Zoom room a tea set or their very own Alexa or something.
Maybe Oprah will make a special appearance on the Five Things. But short of that, we do have something, Brooke. There's that video of us on the registration page.
Oh, right. And you still have your pandemic beard. So yes, that is something that people can go look at.
So yes, rush to the registration page for the free video and a sneak peek at my sort of pandemic beard. And if you are so moved, maybe you'll sign up for the whole shebang. The URL is crazy long, so we'll put it in the show notes for you, or you can Google Five Things Grant and Brooke and see what comes up.
That's right. Google Five Things Grant and Brooke. We think it's only going to go one place, and hope to see y'all on June 12th at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm super excited to talk with our guest today, Fred Dust. Fred is a designer, educator, author, and consultant, and a leading voice and practitioner of human-centered design and networked innovation. Fred was most recently a senior partner and global managing director at the international design firm IDEO. And prior to IDEO, Fred worked as an architect and spent 8 years working with independent artists and major art organizations. He chairs the board of Parsons and sits on the board of the New School, NPR, and the Sundance Institute. And he lives in New York City, and he just wrote this fantastic eye-opening book or ear-opening book on conversation called Making Conversation. Welcome, Fred.
So happy to be here. I love both your work so much. So thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you, Fred. I was so happy to come across your book because it dawned on me when I learned about it that having conversations is something most of us just do. We don't think about the way we have conversations too much, and yet they're so important to our happiness and success in all matters. And I hadn't thought of conversations as something to design, to make instead of just having them in the more passive sense. So I was wondering if you could tell us why you, an architect, a designer of buildings, decided to become a designer of conversations and write a book about conversations.
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, I really didn't have a choice. But I think a lot of the genesis of it came out of working with the kind of not the last administration, but the administration before. I ended up working a lot with the Obama administration, had the good fortune to work with Elizabeth Warren, the Surgeon General then, Vivek Murthy, who's also the Surgeon General now. And what I began to realize as I was doing that work is that so much of the work was really about not so much talking policy, thinking about design in traditional ways. It was about getting people together at a table and kind of hacking through to a solution. And that took really designing the conversation. And so after the elections shifted the whole government structure, I was like, well, what do I do? Because like all my clients had disappeared. Government wasn't hiring us, like whatever. And I was like, well, what did I learn from that? And I was like, I learned that you can design a conversation and that you probably need to design conversations. And so quit my job, wrote a book, and turns out it was a useful thing I've written.
Well, Fred, I like that you did this deep study of conversations and the way they happen in different cultures and different places, too. So you went on a journey to Spain and the Himalayas. You sat in Quaker meetings. You talked to rabbis. You spoke to psychologists and anthropologists also. What were your crucial learnings from that exploration?
Well, Brooke, there's a funny story, actually, I'll tell you, which goes back to like me selling the book, which is that I had originally written a book that was almost entirely about how we'd lost conversation in the world. It was really pretty negative. And, you know, you sell a book and your publisher takes you to like a fancy lunch, and it's like it's Nobu in New York. It's in the basement of HarperCollins building. And you know, they're like, we love the book, anything you want, we're not going to touch it. And you're like, thanks, that's so fantastic. I really chose the right publisher. And then my publisher says, oh, except for your book's entirely about how we lost conversation in the world, and we need the book to be entirely optimistic and positive. I was like, well, that's a different book. And she's like, I know, but it's the book we need. And so the reality is she was right. But to do that meant that I had to go out and really kind of explore to find places where people had really made spectacular, impossible seeming conversations happen, and how they done that, and what was the kind of creative force around it. Brooke, the biggest change for me during the process, though, was when I started to just meet with everyday people and realized that they could do it as well as like the Dalai Lama could, that you could actually like, you could take a, you know, a grandmother in Salt Lake City and talk about her sex book club and see creativity in play as much as you could do it if you were talking about, you know, going on the Camino de Santiago. So
that's so interesting, Fred. And, you know, I've never truly thought of having a conversation as an act of creativity per se. I mean, some conversations, especially with friends, are playful and improvisational, and they lead to interesting thoughts and places. But I'm curious about your definition of conversations, you know, being more intentional acts of creativity, and what goes into making a conversation creative.
Yeah, and I it's a great point, and it's a good moment for me to clarify that I am not, because sometimes like people come across the book and they're like, really, I have to think about all these things and now making conversation as well. And I'm like, it's not every conversation, right? Like, it's not gossip, it's not chit chat, it's all that stuff is like, that's good stuff, and let it be. But I really focus on the conversations where there's really kind of a couple things. Something has to happen. Something has to get made out of that conversation. Otherwise, you know, we have dire consequences. Conversations where there's difference in the room, either difference of opinion or different people, people who you might not feel safe with, or they might not feel safe with you. Those are conversations I really care about. And then I really think about the conversations where, you know, where you just have a pit in your stomach before you're going into it, and you're like, I really dread this conversation. And those are the ones where I really want to make you kind of think about how to be creative about it, so you don't have to have that pit. So you can actually kind of like go in and feel like, I can do this. There's ways I can make that happen.
So I'm curious to know, because it sounds like these are conversations that you're really planning in advance in some way, but is there a way when you're with friends or with a partner or with a parent, when you can stop yourself and say, actually, this really deserves a creative approach? Is it something that you can do in the moment, or does it always require advanced forethought?
No. And in fact, I really encourage you to kind of like really pay close attention to the moments where you feel like there's something that's kind of gone awry. So two things that I talk about in the book. One is, you're not supposed to have, I guess you can have favorite chapters, like you can have favorite kids. But chapter 6, which is on change, is one of my favorite chapters. And it's really about the idea that it's important in a conversation to notice when a change happens. So if you see, so when I talked about this religious women's sex book club, the big thing that changed their conversations was not the conversation itself. It was about the fact that after they read 50 Shades of Grey, Donna Ree, who was the kind of host of the conversation, was like, wait a second, everyone, we've all changed. And we should kind of notice that. So I believe there's a lot of interventions in a conversation where you say, oh, something changed in this. Let's notice it and think about that. Another kind that I talk about a lot, that I think about a lot, is, you know, like when something triggers you and you get like these kind of, your hackles go up. And your initial response is to be like angry or whatever that is. I often ask people just to kind of take a deep breath at that moment, you know, reflect for a moment and just be like, what about that conversation kind of is going wrong? So in the book, I talk about this story, which is, I'm going to just say, because it's one of my favorite stories ever, of one of the most scary conversations I ever had, is when I moved to New York from California. We were in this kind of fifth floor walk-up, I was there alone. My husband wasn't there yet. My dog wasn't there yet. It's like, we'd been moving all day. The movers were like exhausted. And suddenly like there's someone screaming and pounding on my outside, on my door on the fifth floor. And I open it and there's like this 5'7" woman, classic angry New Yorker neighbor. And she's just yelling at me because I've done everything wrong, everything wrong. And I'm sitting here being like, I'm from California. I'm a total wuss. I'm just going to like take this. And then I was like, no, I'm going to jump down her throat. And I took a breath and was about to just yell at her. And then I just said, is this really the conversation we want to have right now? And she was like, no, it's not. And we were able to redirect the conversation in place. So often it's just kind of taking a moment, pausing, taking a breath, and you can then ask for the conversation you want to have. And if that person can't do that, then be like, maybe we don't have the conversation now.
I love that idea of asking for the conversation you want to have. It's such a simple moment, but so important. And since you've written a book now and you've experienced all of the steps of publishing a book, I'm curious, you mentioned one key conversation with your editor at lunch, but I'm kind of curious in the developmental process of the book, if there were any key conversations that mattered along the way, whether it was getting writing feedback from your editor or receiving edits, and, you know, if there are any moments where you needed to kind of really, you know, create a conversation.
Yeah. I mean, so like the best advice I ever got was from an Uber driver in LA. She's like a 20-year-old woman, black woman from the South. She was very, very Christian, and she really wanted to break into the writer's room in LA so she could actually kind of make sure that her values were kind of put there. And we were in a 3-hour traffic jam trying to get to the airport. And so we had no choice but just to talk for those 3 hours. Well, I guess we could have, but that's my way, is just to talk. And she was a writer. And one of the things she told me was she was like, oh, you know, there's no such thing as writer's block. You just should write where you are. And what she meant was like, wherever your head is, just write. If you write on your phone, write on your phone. Just like, it's like, do it when it strikes. And obviously so many people had been like, give yourself 6 hours every morning and blah, 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 and whatever. And I found that that was really the best piece of advice. That and my publisher saying to me at that same lunch, just write 800 words a day and you'll have 500 pages at the end of the year, which I did. I mean, the book was a 500 page book that got marked down to a slim 200 pages.
We're familiar with that. So I'm hoping we could do a little conversational role play here. Many writers, as I'm sure you know, live in fear of getting feedback about their work. And I don't think there's any writer, even the most seasoned, that's free from anxiety when receiving feedback. So what kind of conversation starter, or what might you offer up to writers when it comes to asking for feedback or setting up a writer's group so that everyone gets constructive, creative feedback that's not threatening on the one hand, but also not weak and watered down on the other?
Yeah, it's a great question. And you know, as a designer, one of the things that I've had to do all my life is kind of offer critique. And it's like, and especially if you're a designer where you're critiquing your people's work and they work for you, there's this kind of like really powerful power dynamic, right? That comes into play. And so one of the things that I've done in my own critique in my work, as I've kind of gone out and had to do critique on design work or creative work in general, and because we're still writing, like now I'm like writing with a whole kind of group of people. It's almost like atelier style writing. And we are always giving each other feedback. And what's fascinating is in design, what I would often do is sort of say, recognize that I had the power, right? Because I was kind of about to give people feedback on their work. So I would say, I would hand the rules back over to the designers and say, what should I not touch in this? What's precious to you? What are you not ready for feedback on? And they would tell you. And then you'd say, where do you think you need the most help? And they would tell you. And then you'd kind of go there. And what you would find is, as you started working on the places where you need more help, if it went back to some of the things that were untouchable, people would gradually open up because they realized you were doing it in a constructive way, right? It wasn't about kind of trying to tear somebody down. That's not, by the way, when I was in architecture school, that's not the way critique was given. Critique was horrific. I mean, I'm not joking. There was a lot of substance abuse. I don't know if you know this, Brooke, but many, many women don't make it through architecture practice because the critique process is so vicious. It's at least funny, the gender dynamics that play out in it. So it's just that's one of the tricks I have. But by the end, my editor was able to be like, in Google Doc, be like, yeah, there's something wrong with your head. And I'd be like, oh yeah, you're totally right. And I was just like, that was funny because that's kind of where we got to at that point. Like, it was just like, it was so easy and so kind of fluid over time.
Fred, do you have time for one more role play exercise here?
Yeah. Did I do okay on that one?
Well, yeah, because we're doing another one. Okay. I want to give writers something really tangible to take with them from your wisdom here. And this one actually comes from my experience, but I know that many other writers have experienced it as well. And the scenario is that you're an author. And, you know, when you're an author, you're so kind of disempowered in a lot of ways, or you're just so happy to be published. So you're really beholden to the editor and the whole team you're working with. But let's say the editor, you know, sends you the cover designs that he or she's been given for your book. And then the editor says, everyone on the team is so excited about this design. I've heard this twice now. And when I hear that everyone on the team, you know, that phrase, everyone on the team says, I don't feel like the environment is like set up for like my feedback or for a creative conversation. But I also know that if I don't say anything, I'm stuck with a bad cover for the rest of my lifetime. But if I do say, you know, things, I can alienate the people I'm working with. So I'm just kind of curious how you might handle that conversation, since you're actually on the other side of it a lot.
Yeah, well, it's really funny. I'm going to give you exactly that example, and then I'll give you another example where that happened to me. But so when my publisher sent me the covers for the book, she was like, you're a designer, you're going to hate this, you can hire your own designer. And I was like, good, I'm going to, because it was like, I hated it. So it's like, so it was quite fortunate. And I'm actually quite happy with what we ended up with. And they were lovely and paid for it. And it was a really nice thing. So I had, that's one place where I had luck. But I will tell you, there was one point when I was getting edits back from my publisher, who I adore. She was also my editor. But I mean, she was so good. The reason I went with HarperCollins is that when you meet with people, they give you kind of like a pitch back, like, here's what we think your book is about. And she was like, we think your book is kind of like mindfulness for conversation. And I was like, that's it, we're going for it. In chapter three, I talk about naming things and why there's real value in putting names to things and what matters there. And I got an edit back from her that was like, it was basically like something like, well, you wouldn't not name your baby, so definitely you should name your work baby. And I was like, yeah, if I said that, my friends would kill me. So I actually just went back to her and I was like, come on. Like, it's like, I would be slaughtered if I said that. And she was like, oh, you're right, do whatever you need to do. So we had a great relationship where I felt like I was just like, this doesn't sound like my voice. And your whole the whole point is you want it to be in my voice. And so by kind of being able to use that to say, like, you've come to me saying, bring your voice into this. And if you're putting words in my mouth that don't sound like me, people will hear it. And that was a really great way to kind of go back and forth. But I was lucky, Grant, I was really lucky, because not every editor and publisher is quite as invested in the work as mine was.
That's a great story. Well, Fred, before you go, I just wanted to tell everyone that you've launched a special online text-based curriculum for having better conversations. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. So, like, you know, not everybody is a reader, and during a pandemic, not everybody can really focus, as you know. And so, while writing a book for me was the single most kind of creative, important endeavor of my life. I never thought I could do it. I also had a lot of people who were like, we would love to get this content, but we're in Kenya and it's hard for us to get the book, or we're in rural India and we can't get the book. And so what I've done is I've built a kind of a curriculum. It's basically a 14-day audio-based curriculum that's delivered by SMS, either by text or WhatsApp. And it's given right to your phone. And it's like just a 90-second of me kind of giving you a prompt to think about. So I think one of my favorites is I give a prompt about describe your friends tonight as a cocktail, you know, it's like, and play that little game and see how that goes or something like that. And then it gives you something to kind of practice with. And then the next day a new piece of content comes in. So it's really only, it's 14 days. You'll get sick of my voice by the end of 14 days. I know I did, but it's a fun and easy way if you can't get the book or can't access the book.
Well, great. Well, thank you so much, Fred. This is a lot to think about. So thanks for joining us.
It was a delight. I'm very fangirl of you guys. So.
Thank you, Fred. It's been a lot of fun to have you. We'll be right back with today's book talk.
Well, Welcome back, everybody. This week's book pick is largely about conversations as well. It's called Craft in the Real World. It's by Matthew Salicis. And this book is really challenging. It challenges current models of craft and the writing workshop by showing how they fail marginalized writers and how cultural expectations inform storytelling. So he really upends Western notions of how a story must progress. And he asks questions about how we can rethink craft and the teaching of it and how to better reach writers with diverse backgrounds. For example, I love that he defines craft as a set of expectations. And because expectations are not universal, even though we think of them that way often, he says they're often culturally determined and standardized, and that this leads to certain types of stories being seen as the gold standard, you know, such as psychological realism in a lot of Western fiction, which becomes exclusionary, actually, because of its norms. He does a great job of discussing that and how what doesn't fit the model is oftentimes othered. So I've just started the book, so I look forward to more, but I love the way that Salicis is interrogating a lot of what is seen as the universal norms of storycraft and how he's opening up really rich pathways to other stories and other ways to talk about them.
Wow, what an important book for our time. So thanks for that recommendation, Grant. And thank you to all of you listeners out there. We're certainly appreciative that you tune in week out. As always, we appreciate it if you share with your friends, let your writing circles know that we're out there, leave a review, all the things we ask for each week. We're very grateful, and we'll see you next week.